Hi, I'm Dr. Michael Bird. I'm the Deputy Principal at Ridley College in Melbourne, Australia. I am an Anglican priest, a New Testament scholar, a general lover of the church. I really enjoy tennis, love Jesus, and absolutely despise coffee with a passion. And, you know, I just like doing anything, studying the Bible, studying early Christian texts, thinking about what it means to be a follower of Christ in today's world. I love some real epic Bible nerd stuff, getting into, you know, the intricacies of Greek, you know, talking about the church fathers, wrestling with modern theologians, struggling with the big topics of our day, like what does it mean to be a human being? You know, what is this thing we call identity? How does sexuality affect who we are? Why we should listen more to the global church? You know, what should we think about Christian nationalism? And yeah, I enjoy all that stuff. I enjoy researching it, talking about it, and figuring out in a community with others, in my own college, in my own church, what it means to be a follower of Jesus in my own context. And I'm always glad to talk about that and share that with others, including my great host here, David Capes.
Dr. Michael Bird, Mike, good to see you. Welcome to the Stone Chapel Podcast.
David, thank you for having me.
What an introduction. I mean, that told us a lot of stuff about you right there. I mean, we kind of have your CV, not your CV exactly, but we have a lot of what makes you tick, which is great.
Well, there's a lot that makes me tick. But the main thing that makes me tick is the attempt to have a faith-seeking understanding.
Well, and you've done a great deal about that. I mean, you're very active. Let's talk a little bit about some of the work that you've done. I mean, you've done lots of books, and we'll put in the show notes, we'll put some links to those things. But you're also a very active blogger. So if people want to find out more about Mike Bird, how would they do that on the internet?
Yeah, you can find me on, I think it's called michaelfbird.substack.com. That's where I kind of do my blogging these days. Mm. And yeah, I mean, I'm also on Twitter a bit, and I even started on that thing called Threads, although I can't really figure out how to use it properly. And
well, you're very public. It, what we've talked earlier today about how well versed you are not only in politics in Australia but also in America, and how that works. I mean, I'm learning stuff sometimes listening to your blog and watching you. And reading your stuff about what's going on here in America, because I just don't watch that stuff here.
Yeah. Well, I tend to think the politics of America is too important to leave it just to Americans. I know some Americans may not like hearing that, but yeah. I mean, you have to appreciate that if you speak English and if you read CNN, you're on Twitter or Facebook, you are inundated with American news and commentary all the time, you know, and you'll have your own local news. But, you know, I'm hearing news about, you know, Donald Trump's indictments. I'm hearing about the bushfires in Hawaii. I'm finding out about, you know, fans complaining about Taylor Swift tickets in America. So my news cycle, besides the local Australian and Melbourne stuff, I'm getting inundated with American stuff. So I feel like I live in like in the, what, 51st or 52nd state of America, yeah, simply by being in this Anglophone world.
Well, we'll welcome you. We'll put our 51st star on the flag. How about that? Welcoming Australia to the family.
Oh, that'd be great. I've always wanted to be the governor of an American state. You know, maybe I like North Carolina. I think I'd make a good governor of North Carolina. I think I could pull that off.
I know some people who are pretty high up over there, so I'll be glad to recommend you. Hey, listen, we're here today to talk about your book, excellent book called Jesus Among the Gods, Early Christology in the Greco-Roman World, and it's published by Baylor University Press, and it's been out a little while, so I'm a little slow getting to you on here. I know you've probably done lots of interviews on this, but I wanted to take my stab at a conversation with you for our audience, because I want them to know you. You've already been to the Lanier Theological Library to lecture back about, 2016, I think it was, several years back, and we were looking forward to the day you can come back. But in the meantime, this is a terrific book. I have it right next to my book by Larry Hurtado, Destroyer of the Gods, because these two books sort of remind me of each other in some ways. Mm. That's a pretty good place to be on my shelf.
Yeah. I should say, for those who don't know, the book is actually dedicated to David. So thanking him for many years of friendship and also for his own contribution to the study of Christology in the New Testament. So, yeah, but we do have a common interest in talking about the divinity of Christ in the New Testament, David.
Mm-hmm. And in the early church and how that sort of manifests itself in the first, second, third centuries, right? And we actually co-edit a project called Studies in Early Christology that we're working on, and we've got several volumes coming out, I think, this year. And we had one come out last year in the form of a God with Perryman. Andrew Perryman did a great job. Wonderful guy, and enjoyed my conversations with him. So when we talk about this book, when we think about this book, what was the big idea for you as you wrote this book?
Well, the idea goes back to a debate I did with Bart Ehrman several years ago when his book came out, How Jesus Became God, where he's got his own particular thesis about how the early church came to the conclusion that Jesus was God. And for Ehrman, to his credit, he says it wasn't a long, drawn-out process, that they thought he was a human, then at the Council of Nicaea they made him God, or...
So 300 years later, right? 300 years later.
Yeah. I mean, this is the Dan Brown view. Ehrman is good that the early church regarded Jesus as God pretty much from the beginning, at least from the moment of belief in his resurrection and exaltation. And I think Ehrman, I mean, this is when I did my critique of him, I probably should have given him a little bit more credit on this side. And the credit is on in what did they mean by that? Because the word God is not univocal. It's not a monolithic quality or entity. There are different ways of being divine in antiquity. In the ancient world, there's this kind of a spectrum of divinity, different definitions of divinity. And on that point, I think he was right, which then begs the question, where in ancient notions of divinity did Jesus fit in? Exactly. In the minds of the early church, the apostles. And the second thing that sort of matches up with this is when I was spending some time up in the Pacific Northwest, hanging out with my good friends at Logos Bible Software, and I went into a little bookstore and I found an old Loeb copy of, I think, Plutarch's Moralia. I think I can probably maybe see a copy behind you there, David.
Yeah, I got some back there.
With your green Loeb collection behind you. And he was talking about there were two different worships of the god Apollo, and he says there's one type of worship where he's an unbegotten god and another type of worship where he's a begotten god. And I thought all that language about begotten and eternally begotten, I thought that was technical Christian language that they developed in the fourth century. Turns out that's not the case at all, that in the ancient world amongst Greeks, Romans, Jews, and then Christians as well, that they could divide deities, gods, into almost two categories. There were these unbegotten or absolute divine beings, mm-hmm. like Zeus or Jupiter or Dios, as he was called. And then there's these begotten deities, people who kind of get promoted or elevated to divinity, or they become deified. And that's like a Heracles or the healing god Asclepius, or a Roman emperor, exactly. or something like that. And it got me thinking, well, if that are the two categories that people that are using, then which one did the early Christians put Jesus into? Now, sometimes they really do use this explicit language, even in the early second century. I mean, Ignatius of Antioch at one point seems to say, if I read him correctly, that Jesus is unbegotten in his divinity, but begotten in his humanity. So in terms of divinity, he's got an absolute status of divinity, but he's participated also in our humanity, which is kind of like what the Nicene Creed says, that he's, true God and true man. Mm-hmm. And you find sort of similar things in somewhere like the Epistle to Diognetus, where, you know, there's the statement that Jesus is kind of like an absolute divine being. He's a king because he's the son of a king, okay? So the son of a king is a king, like the son of a duck is a duck. And yet it also says, if you are benevolent to the people around you, if you help the poor, you're acting like a god to them. So you've got the two ideas of divinity there, one which is absolute divinity, and then one is what, I mean, I call it euergetic divinity, but it means like through your patronage, you show godlike benevolence. So you can be relationally a god by doing good things for people, or you can be an absolute deity. And that completely blew my mind and knocked several pairs of my socks off. And I thought, I need to go through and do a big study of early Christianity and think, where do people place Jesus on this taxonomy of divinity? And that led to a big rabbit hole where I was then comparing Jesus to all sorts of intermediary figures. How is Jesus similar or different to a deified emperor? How is he similar or different to ancient Greek ideas of wisdom or the Logos? What's the similarities between Jesus and this mysterious Son of Man in the parables of Enoch? What's that got to do with Revelation? And then ancient ruler cults and all sorts of fun things. And the resulting product of that investigation was this book, Jesus Among the Gods.
So this is a process that you've been engaged in for a number of years, it sounds like. You've been thinking about this for a
while. Yeah, it's been thinking, you know, what did it, when the early Christians called Jesus God or divine, what did they mean by that? And how was it continuous and discontinuous within the Greco-Roman world, you know, with the Jewish thought within the wider Hellenistic context?
One of the things that has happened is there seemed to be a time when it was all Greco-Roman, and then a time that was all Jewish, and you didn't really need to consider the Greco-Roman. But it seems to me that you sort of brought that stuff back together and wedded it. Yeah, I think the analogy you use is something like the church is closer to the synagogue than it is to the Temple of Mithraeus or something like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's closer to the synagogue, and yet it's not discontinuous in a way with what we find in the ancient world in Greco-Roman circles.
Yeah, I mean, because you've got the problems that some people want to say Judaism and Hellenism or the Greco-Roman world were completely set apart. They were, you know, partitioned off from each other, doing their own separate thing. And then you got the other view that says basically Hellenistic Judaism is just Hellenism without a foreskin. I mean, in other words, you know, they want to put it in that kind of bland way as if Hellenistic Judaism is just Hellenism. Yeah. But that's not the case. I don't think either of you are correct. And I use the example of the book of Hebrews. You know, the book of Hebrews, written in Greek, draws on a lot of styles of Greek rhetoric. There's a bit of an influence of even Platonic philosophy, although I think it may be a little bit overdrawn. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it's clearly part of Hellenistic culture. But 25% of the book is based on quotations from the Old Testament.
Absolutely.
Okay, 25% of the book. I mean, so the Greek translation of the Old Testament. But, you know, that goes to show that, you know, it's not either or. You know, it's the book of Hebrews participates in Hellenistic culture, but the way it provides its own discourse and description of who Jesus is largely using the Old Testament. And I mean, that for me, that's very indicative of the point I'm trying to make. We don't have to choose between Greco-Roman or Jewish views. We've got to understand the confluence and the interface between them and how that applies in different parts of the New Testament, indeed even in early Christianity.
And one of the things I describe with this book is the fact that you attempt to give something that was needed, which is a kind of a taxonomy of divinity. What is it in that taxonomy you think really comes from a Greco-Roman environment?
Well, I think there's a couple of things. The first of all, the idea that they're a god who is unbegotten is the absolute deity. Now, I think in the Jewish world, they have the same thing, but they would talk about the uncreated creator. Or to use the language of, you know, Isaiah, you know, I am the Lord your God, there is none like me. or to whom can we compare you? Okay, so there is a sense in Jewish monotheism in which, you know, Yahweh is not the only divine being. There's angels, demons, or these sort of lesser gods. I mean, Yahweh is God of gods.
Right, right.
But Yahweh is species unique. Mm-hmm. It's like comparing the Atlanta Braves with the Griffin under-12s baseball team, you know, the under-12s. That's two teams in the same area, but they are not in the same leagues. The Atlanta Braves, you know, up against the Griffin under-12s. Griffin's a little town outside Atlanta, for those who don't know.
Listen, how do you know that? I mean, I'm just mystified by it.
I had a friend who was from Griffin, and I went and visited him. And I once met a Presbyterian Mission to the World missionary in Australia. And he said, I said to him, where are you from? And he said, I'm from just outside Atlanta. And I said, let me guess, Griffin? And then he looked at me with this sense of shock that he'd met an Australian who'd heard of the city of Griffin. He was dumbfounded. It was...
So that is a really interesting analogy for thinking about divinity. There's been a lot of conversation about monotheism and whether the term monotheism ought to be retired. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah,
Paula Fredrickson, I think, was one of the first people to talk about that. Is it a useful term?
I think it is a useful term. I mean, it depends what you mean by it. If you think that Yahweh is the only divine being there is, like an absolute metaphysical monotheism, then, well, no, it's not correct. Okay, so because, like, again, Yahweh is God of gods, so there's this heavenly constellation of angels, lesser things. But again, the point of monotheism is not the number of divine beings, is that Israel provides their worship alone to Yahweh, so it's monolatrous. This is the only God who delivers them. And this is what's emphasized in a lot of places, whether it's the Dead Sea Scrolls or the Hebrew Bible or Josephus. Israel's God Yahweh is species unique. No one is in his status. And in fact, if you accent that strong enough, you can end up with a situation where you begin talking like Yahweh is the only God, or something along those lines. And even in the Hebrew Bible, you find something a little bit like that. You know, for example, one of my favorite lines in the Old Testament, when Naaman the Syrian gets healed, this is what he says. He says, "Now I know there is no God in all the earth except in Israel. Please accept a present from your servant." Now that line, there is no God in all the earth. I mean, this guy's a pagan, but he's saying things that almost makes it sound like Israel's deity is either the only one there is, or in the very least, the only one who really matters, you know. And that's from 2 Kings 5:15. I mean, the other thing that frustrates me is when people find some little archaeology of little minarets of little deities, and they find evidence of other deities being worshipped in ancient Israel, and they say, "Don't you know that even the ancient Israelites were not monotheistic?" To which I reply, like, you mean just like the ancient prophets were always complaining about? So, This is not news. You're saying, like, some of the ancient Israelites were not actually monotheists. And I go, yeah, like, exactly what the biblical prophets were complaining about most of the time. So I still think it is a useful term. If you think of it, the exclusivity of Israel's worship and how Yahweh is species unique, I think it is a good term. And some people have tried to dispense with it. You know, Matthew Lynch and Benjamin Summer are the people who I think have done the best work recently. And Joachim Schrapper as well have done some great work, I think, trying to maintain the fitness and utility of the term monotheism over and against those who are trying to, I think, somewhat dismissively get rid of it.
Yeah, and to say all polytheism all the time, and we should just recognize that. Jesus Among the Gods, Early Christology in the Greco-Roman World by Michael F. Byrd. It's a fantastic book, and we commend it. We have copies at the Lanier Theological Library, your friendly theological library. And we just bought one today to go to Yarnton in Oxford. So I know that book is headed over there to be a part of that collection once that library gets established. Dr. Michael Byrd, thanks for being with us today on the Stone Chapel Podcast.
David, thanks for having me, and thank you to listening for all of your audience.
hold the phone for a nugget of wisdom from our guest coming up in just a moment. Thanks to Kathy Capes for her expertise in bringing this podcast to you. Thanks to Phil Keggy for our music. If you enjoy the Stone Chapel podcast, why not stop what you're doing right now and subscribe? Share it with your friends on social media, especially those interested in theology. Come on, you know you want to. Once you do that, it keeps these winsome words coming your way and helps rank us higher on every search engine. If you have questions, comments, or you just want to be in touch, email us at podcast@lanierlibrary.org. That's podcast@lanierlibrary.org. Lanier is spelled L-A-N-I-E-R. Now, until next time, thanks for listening.
When someone asks me, what is a great way to summarize the Christology of the New Testament? But when I think about a way to, you know, just sum up the Christology of the New Testament, I come down to a little refrain, which I believe is attributable to Martin Luther, and it goes like this: no other God have I but thee, born in a manger, died on a tree. If someone was to ask me to summarize the Christology of the New Testament, that cute little refrain with its rhyme, its brevity, I think is a great way of summing it up. No other God have I but thee, born in a manger, died on a tree.